This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The dark nooks of the southern forest where Scary Larry Ott spends his lonely childhood set the perfect backdrop for his grim life. He lives in shadows and emptiness, dogged by an accusation he cannot escape. His one-time friend, Silas 32 Jones, has lived a brighter life. He escaped their fading hamlet for a while on a baseball scholarship and now serves as the town constable. When a young woman goes missing in their Mississippi town, the two friends' paths cross again. That's the setup for Tom Franklin's new book, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. Tom's the author of three previous works. He teaches writing at the University of Mississippi and joins me now. Tom, welcome to the State of Things.
Good glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
We should first talk about that title, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. It's something that most people who grew up in the South are going to be familiar with.
Yeah, it's how Southern children are taught to spell Mississippi. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, humpback I. So crooked letters are S's and humpbacks were P's.
So you have established yourself as a Southern writer right off the bat. The place is now
very important,
whether you like it or not. The title is a reference to the book's setting. There were other reasons for choosing that, though, weren't there?
There were. I thought it was such a great title in the first place. It was surprising to me that no one had used that for a book title. You know, there are very few good book titles left. So I was writing the book originally to be set in Alabama, as my other three books are. But when I considered that title, I thought I got to move it to Mississippi. It sounded like a crime novel to me, and it sounded like Elmore Leonard might have written it. So I'm proud of the title. I'm happy with it.
Because it would have been a hockey stick. You know, it just wouldn't. You'd have been stuck for sure. Tell me about the two characters who inhabit this book, Scary Larry Ott and Silas 32 Jones.
Yeah, Scary Larry is a mechanic's son who is not popular in school and has few friends in the first place until Silas Jones moves to town. He moves there with his mother. And they have a kind of secret friendship. And actually, the character of Scary Larry is based very much on me. Many of his the events in his past are events from my past, and I did have a secret black friend for a while. So a lot of this is autobiographical. But for Silas, who is the black character, Silas, his nickname is 32 Jones. He came from somewhere else entirely. I was writing this book about two white characters, and a friend of mine, David Wright, who is African-American, actually has written a book about the Outer Banks called Fire on the Beach. David and I were talking about this book one night years ago, and I was complaining about how hard it was to write it. I didn't quite know what the story was yet, and I said it's about a mechanic with no customers and a small-town police officer. And David said, why don't you make the small-town cop a black guy? And I said, oh, well, I hadn't thought of that. And you know, it made me nervous to consider writing from a black man's point of view. But he said, I'll help you. And he read it for me. And you know, without him, I don't think I would have tried that.
Well, tell us about that collaboration and trying to inhabit a black character.
Well, I found it to be very hard. And you know, I began to look at how I wrote white characters differently. And back looked very closely. One thing I noticed is as writing from a white man's point of view, whenever that character would notice another character, another white man, he would be identified as a man. You know, he saw a man approaching. But if it were a black man, he would identify the other race. You know, he saw a black man approaching. So I reversed that for Silas. He saw a man or he saw a white man. That was, you know, I think the very surface way that I began to do it. And I thought about it a lot. And, ultimately remembered a story that David had told me, David Wright had told me. He and I met in Illinois. We both taught at Knox College there in Galesburg, Illinois. And he convinced my wife and me to use the maid that he and his wife used. And she was a white woman. I said, great, you know, we'll try a maid. We'd never had a maid before, and I felt a bit of guilt about it. You know, I should clean up my own messes. But you know, eventually we tried his maid, and we liked her. And at one point, David and I were talking in a bar at night, and he said, does she do your toilets? And I said, yeah, why? He said, she won't do ours. And I thought, okay, you know, David feels this a lot, probably, and things that I wouldn't have even imagined, he would notice. So that helped me a bit. And but eventually, I just stopped thinking about it and wrote Silas as a man with, you know, without worrying about it. And when I finished the book, when I drafted it, I sent it to David, who found probably 11 or 12 places where I got race wrong. You know, they were all nuanced things. For example, Silas's mother, Alice, you know, I had her thinking and using one, I had her think colored, and David said, no, she would probably think black. She's a bit older, and colored wasn't really used at that point. Hmm. So things like that he really helped me with.
And Silas Jones, the black character, is the constable, another regionalism. I don't know if we have many constables these days up this way, but maybe we do. I might get a phone call in a minute. He's the white character, Larry Ott, Scary Larry, has a shadow that hangs over him. Tell us about that.
Larry had one date in his life. He took a neighbor girl to the drive-in movie, and she's never seen again. And this paints his whole life for him.
He's never convicted?
He's never convicted or indicted, and he never confesses. So, and nobody's found. So he's just left to live his life alone. But as a pariah, no one will speak to him. In Walmart, the clerks look at him funny. Everyone knows who he is. When he orders KFC, the girls are rude to him, and you know the clerks are rude to him.
Now, interestingly enough, you said that Larry is the character your life parallels Larry's, and you had an episode very much like this one.
Absolutely. My first date, she and I were going to the drive-in, and on the way she told me, I need to see my boyfriend. And her boyfriend was a big guy, played football. And she told me that her parents would only let her date me because her parents knew my parents, and they thought I was safe, and I probably was. I certainly wasn't, you know, any Scary Larry. But instead of taking one to the drive-in with her, I took her to her boyfriend's house, dropped her off, and went to the drive-in by myself.
Now, this was at her request, we should point out, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't your idea.
No. In the book, she sends Larry to the drive-in by her. That's her order. In real life, I had nothing else to do. I had 4 hours to kill, and I couldn't go home because my parents were really thrilled that I finally had a date. I was 16. I never had a date. They were worried about me. So I just couldn't go home. I was too embarrassed, and I really couldn't drive around for 4 hours. So I went to the drive-in and parked at the front where the kids usually – where families parked, hoping no one would notice me. But, of course, I'd bragged about the date a little bit, and a friend pulled in behind me just as it was getting dark. And, you know, and I knew what went on at the drive-in movie because my brother and I had gone to this drive-in since I could drive every weekend because they showed R-rated movies. And we could see nudity, and we liked that, you know, ages 16 and 14. And I had plans to, get lucky that night at the drive-in. You know, I'd park back in the back by the trees, and the windows would fog up. So when my friend pulled in behind me, I took a blanket I'd brought just in case and put it over my hand as if it were my date's head and held it up there in silhouette. I hoped it looked like a person sitting beside me in the car.
Tom Franklin, that is the saddest story I've ever heard in my life.
You know, I tell it a lot, and actually it gets big laughs. And I tried to write it. I tried to write it as an essay, and I couldn't write it. I told it so many times that I couldn't make it funny on the page.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with Larry, what happens to him, he takes the girl to her. He doesn't know who he takes her to see. He takes her and drops her off and goes to the drive-in by himself and leaves. And when he comes back, he never sees her again. No one ever sees her again. So that's not funny. And so it became very serious, which I'd never considered. I'd never considered making it serious.
Would you read for us?
I will. This is a part. This is from 32's point of view. He is coming back from patrol, and he sees a bunch of buzzards, and he's looking for a body. So he's gonna follow the buzzards. He picked his way along the water's edge, setting off a series of bullfrogs from the cattails and reeds. Cane Creek was more like a slough, he thought. It hardly moved at all, its blackberry water stirred only by the wakes of frogs, or bubbles from the bottom, or bloops the fish made. Among floating leaves and dark black sticks, liquor bottles and their reflections, and faded beer cans and theirs, had collected in coves and turns, and he wondered who the hell would come all the way out here to litter. He fanned his face again, insects like toy planes propellering madly through the high branches. Might just be a bobcat, he thought, come down to the creek to die. That old instinct, hurt, head for water. He thought of his mother, dead 8 years, the time the two of them lived in a hunting cabin on land owned by a white man. No water in the place, no electricity, no gas. There'd been squatters there for less than a week when a one-eared tomcat appeared on the ports just past dark. They shooed it off, but morning found it lying on the steps with a mouse twitching in its jaws. "My lord," his mother said, "that cat's applying for a job." They hired it, and it insinuated itself all the way onto his mother's bed, where she said it warmed her feet. They moved from that cabin a few months later, and the cat moved with them. It would live with him for years, but then, just before he left to go to Oxford his senior year, the cat disappeared. By the time he noticed, his mother said it had been gone nearly a month. "Where?" "Just off, baby," she said. "Off?" She was washing clothes in the sink, still in her hairnet from work. "To die, Silas," she had said. "When an animal's time comes, it goes off to die." The underbrush thinned as he went, the air hotter, muggier, and suddenly the trees had thrown open their arms to a high white sky, a burst of glowing logs and schools of steaming toadstools and clouds of gnats, wet leaves sparkling like mirrors and a spiderweb's glowing wires. A mosquito whined past his ear and he slapped his arms and neck, going faster, leaves plastered to his boots, aware of a sharpness to the air, now a sweet rot. Something 50 yards ahead began to lurch toward him. He stopped and thumbed the quick release of his sidearm as other things moved as well, the earth floor stirring to life. But the thing veered away, flapping into the air, just a buzzard, feet hanging, and then others were winging their duffel bodies over the water or waddling up the bank. The odor grew worse as he stepped closer to where the land gave over to swamp. Farther down, more of the birds lined the bank like crows on steroids, unfeathered necks and heads, and some with faces red and tumored as a rooster's, some stepping from one scaled claw to the other, and some with their beaks open.
Tom Franklin reading from his new novel, Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. Where did the idea for the story come from?
Well, from a few places. I never know what a story is going to be when I start or a novel is going to be when I start. I have an image or an idea. In this case, it was several years in the making. I in 2003, had a vague notion to write a book about brothers. My brother, Jeff, is a mechanic, and he and I are very close but very different in every way. And I'm interested in the idea of people who are different but connected. I stopped writing that book or this book at one point to write my second novel called Smunk, and that took a couple of years in the middle. So then I came back to this one. At that point, the idea had changed, and I'd become interested in the small-town mechanic with no customers. There's a certain garage that I know of, and I passed it hundreds of times, and there's never a customer in the bay door. It's just and the mechanic sits there by himself, and I always found that really fascinating. What does he think in there? What does he do in there?
That's the second saddest story I've ever heard.
And the other idea was, what was a small-town police officer. There's plenty of urban cop stories, right. And not as many small-town. And I grew up in Dickinson, Alabama, which itself was a hamlet. I didn't know that until I read Faulkner's The Hamlet. But it's this tiny, it's just a store. It's what Dickinson was. That store is now closed. But cop was from nearby Fulton, and Dickinson was in his jurisdiction. His name's Larry Hicks. He's still there. He is a deputy now. Now there's two of them. But I was fascinated by Larry. He would ride through Larry Hicks. He would ride through our hamlet a couple times a day, and I found it very interesting. And so those two ideas, I thought first the mechanic was the whole story, and the missing girl was coming back, and she was the one, would be the other character. And then the cop kept insinuating himself. So eventually I realized the two of them were the story.
This is your first foray into mystery or crime novel?
Yes.
Was it difficult for you to write a crime novel?
I didn't write it as a crime novel. I suppose I knew because of the title. It sounded like a crime novel. And the writers I was reading, George Pelicanos, Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, those guys write crime novels. So I guess it was difficult because at some point it occurred to me, I've got two missing girls in this book and someone had to have done away with them. And I got to figure out who that was. So that plot point stuck me for a while. But my first book, Poachers, has a long story, its title story, that won an Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Mystery Story. I had no idea that story was a mystery. I mean, I think all stories have mystery at their heart and all good, a good story should have mysteries at their heart. But I didn't know. And, they called me from New York and said, "You should come to the Edgars." And I said, "Well, I don't, what's that?" "It's a mystery award." And I said, "Well, I don't write mysteries." They said, "Come anyway." So I did. And it's been fun. And then my second book, first novel, Hell at the Breach, is historical. It's set in the 1890s in Alabama. So, you know, I was first a Southern writer, then I was a mystery writer, then I was an historical writer, and now with Crooked Letter, I'm a crime writer. And I think that crime writing encompasses a lot of different categories like mystery and thriller and so on. And a friend of mine is Otto Penzler, who owns a mysterious bookshop in New York and edits Best American Mystery Stories. And his definition of a crime story or a crime novel is a novel that opens with a crime, which mine certainly does. Right. By that definition, Crime and Punishment is a crime novel, he says.
Well, and are we trying – it seems that in the literary world, writers and critics do want to make a distinction between crime novels and genre novels, genre work in general, and literary work. I'm certainly seeing an awful lot of literature in those genres. How about you?
Yeah, Michael Chabon did that great fantasy, Gentleman of the Road, which I love. And a really good recent example is Justin Cronin's book, The Passage. Cronin teaches at the University of Houston, I think, and is a professor. And here is a professor who had written two very literary books that had won literary prizes, has suddenly written an 800-page tome, a post-apocalyptic vampire novel, and it's terrific. It's beautifully written. It's a page-turner. It's the first of a trilogy, and Ridley Scott is doing the movie, and this guy's made a fortune on it. You know, from my own point of view, I wrote three books, actually, that didn't sell very well. You know, they had their, you know, being a Southerner, I have a sort of built-in Southern audience. That's wonderful. But it's hard to get out of the South. And those books really didn't sell that many, you know. And then I have all these friends who write mysteries, or, you know, like, you know, Dennis Lehane really dresses well. I thought, you know, I want to dress better. I want to make a little more, you know, make a little more money, I think. And you need a broader audience to do that.
You know, the other, you talked about being labeled a Southern writer. This book certainly has that key characteristic. The place is a character in your book.
I hope
interesting,
so, yes.
Interestingly enough, you weren't in that place when you were in Brazil, weren't
right,
you?
Right, yeah, yeah. My wife's a poet. Her name's Beth Ann Fennelly, and she won a Fulbright to Brazil a couple of years ago to study the poet Elizabeth Bishop, and took the whole family, me and our two kids at that time. We have three now. And I had 6 months with nothing to do but write, and that's how I finally got this book done. And also, being down in South America, writing about the American South was a strange situation. And I think that's why the character of Larry Ott is so autobiographical, because I was down there living in memory. You know, normally I write about the place where I'm living, Alabama or Mississippi, and I can walk around and I can experience the landscape. I can, you know, smell the trees and describe those things, you know, or see one of those locust husks on the side of a tree, and that'll get something, that'll kick something off in my head, and I can go and use that and, you know, and put it somewhere. Down there, the landscape, of course, is very different. And I think just using so much memory, I got in there, muddied up the water, and just suddenly think so many things about Larry Ott and me were the same. We're both mechanic sons. We're both obsessed with Stephen King as kids. I still am kind of obsessed with – I love Stephen King's work. And nearly every event, except for the fact that my first date didn't disappear, is similar with Larry and me.
Did that give you – being away, being in a different location, give you permission to be more autobiographical?
I think it did. Yeah. I think also getting away gives you perspective in a way. You know, I grew up in Alabama and left and moved north to Arkansas for graduate school when I was 30. And that perspective helped me, you know, to see Alabama differently and I think more kindly. You know, I'd been not happy about a lot of things that have gone on there. And you know, but leaving and I'd go to Arkansas and I would tell them all my weird stories about growing up as a Southerner. And they would say, you should write that. You know, you've had a strange life.
And a sad one.
Yeah.
But sadly successful, but happily successful, I should say. Tom Franklin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Tom Franklin's new book is called Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter. It's available now at local bookstores. Coming up, the Spirit Family Reunion gives us an in-studio preview of their upcoming performance this summer at the Festival for the Eno in Durham. Live music is next. Stay tuned.